Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Nothing to Fear, a weekly horror movie podcast. Each week on the show, we watch a different horror movie and we talk all about it. My name is Billy Schultz, and I'm joined by Alex Wan and Luke Mason, and we are excited to be kicking off Vampire Month this week with From Dusk Till Dawn, which Luke picked. But we're going to talk about that a little bit later, and I'm going to check in with my friend. So, Luke Mason, how the hell are you doing today?
Pretty tired, I would say. Calgary, the April Fool's joke of yesterday is that Calgary revenged Nelson because it snowed here. It doesn't snow very much in April in Nelson, but it did yesterday for about four hours.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
But then it all kind of melted, so it was fine. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's the facade of spring. There's like a week in March over spring break where it was like 13 degrees every day.
Yeah.
Nope. Not for another week now.
It's false spring too. There's always a couple false starts this spring before it really gets going. But Luke, I wanted to share with you a joke that I told in school the other day that did not get as much laughs as I thought it deserved, but I think you'll really appreciate it.
Okay.
So for context, I'm taking a lifespan and development course this year for psychology. And so it talks about developmental stages and what happens across the lifespan. And we have to do a final project at the end of the year. And the professor remarked, is like, every year, people either pick like the infants to like toddler stages or like older adults, like middle age to like elderly people. And nobody takes the middle. Nobody seems to care about the middle. And then I said in class, well, Jimmy Eat World does. And only one person laughed. And I thought, you know who would appreciate this joke? It's Luke Mason.
Yeah. Well, it just takes some time.
I know.
they need some time to get it.
I'm sure they all got home that day and went, oh, that's a good joke. Good job, Billy.
All right. Yeah. All right.
All right. Anyway, I said
did your professor get it?
Yeah, my professor said it because he is a year younger than I am. So, of course, he knows what's up. But, yeah, he was the one person that laughed. And all the other people who were born in the year 2000 were like, what? And then I just felt old.
Well, they all know that song. They've all heard it. They just don't know what it was called.
Exactly. But yeah, so there you go. I was sitting on that joke for upwards of a week, and I was just like, I got to tell it to Luke. I got to tell him. He's got to know. That's a good one. Yes. So I'm glad you appreciate it. And so let's check in with Alex now. Alex Wan.
Hi.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm okay. I feel like I might have said this last year, but I think April Fool's is like my least favorite day of the year because it's gotten to a point where it's like, it's not like a harmless little practical joke or whatever. It's just fucking misinformation and stupidness all day. And I don't know what I'm supposed to believe or understand. And I hate it.
Sounds like you got duped.
I didn't get duped. I just like, I fucking hate the day because like, I just can't look at anything because nothing is real. Unless it is real, and then if it is real, I'm like, I have to like look into it more. I don't want that.
You could always just take a day off the internet.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Can we? In this society.
In this
That's true. I agree. There are some pranks that get way out of hand.
No, not some. I'm going to say it. April Fool's fucking sucks. If your company partakes in April Fool's, fuck you.
Okay. It's also like, I've seen there was a trend of people being like, they would announce like fake pregnancies or fake engagements. And it's like, don't do that. Don't do that. And if your kid was born on April 1st, I'm sorry, but you have to tell everyone tomorrow. You can't tell them on the day.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Your new birthday is April 2nd. No one gets a birthday on April 1st anymore. It's got to be the next day. Well, I'm glad that another April Fool's is in the rearview mirror for us. And we can move on for the next 12 months.
We should make February 29th every year and April 1st only every 4 years.
Oh, there we go.
I feel it's an elegant solution to this very deep problem.
Yeah. Finally get all those, leap year babies to catch up to the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
As for myself, I am doing well. I'm also a little bit tired, which is rare for me on a Sunday, but yesterday, Kelly and I went and checked out the new Dungeons & Dragons movie, which was a lot of fun. And by the time you're hearing this, if you're a Patreon subscriber, there will be a spoiler-free review that I am working on writing up on Patreon. Patreon.com/nothingtofear. Check that out if you want.
You're writing it.
I'm writing it. Yeah, I'm just doing a little. I've done a couple little recaps. I forgot to do one for March. / I didn't get out to the movie theaters in March to see a movie and talk about it. But yeah, I want to share my thoughts about the Dungeons and Dragons movie. I know, Luke, you've got plans to see it on Tuesday. I'd love to hear about it too.
The trailers look hilarious. I'm not as steeped in the lore of Dungeons and Dragons as you, so I'll probably a lot of the jokes I won't get in the same way that you do. But I did play an extended campaign for about 3 or 4 months one time with some friends in Calgary. So I know a little bit about it. So
yeah, it is framed in such a way that if you know D&D, there's plenty for you to look at and go, ah, but if you are newbie to the fantasy genre, there's enough to get you going without being like, am I supposed to know what's funny or why this is funny? Or
so yeah, and I think that's,
it threads that needle.
That is probably the wisdom of a movie studio, which is something we don't say often on this podcast.
Mass market appeal.
Yeah, if a studio is going to put a lot of money into a nerd franchise, they're going to have both jokes.
Exactly, because you need people to get in through the door who are like, you already got the D&D players money, even if it's not a good movie. They're like, oh, I'll probably go check it out. But you need a reason, and that's why you have like a Chris Pine and a Michelle Rodriguez, like they're.
And I think it's got over 90 on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's got great reviews.
Yeah, I think it's doing well, and so yay.
And I have to say, like, I always appreciate an actor who can do both drama and comedy well. And Chris Pine is funny. There's some roles where he's just a funny guy. And
he's, yeah.
That's not like his typecast, I would say, but he's still got some comedic chops, so.
Yeah, he's funny and he makes the jokes work and he plays it just straight enough to not be like obnoxious, and he's not like winking at the camera ever, or, you know, it's not like a fish out of water where someone's like, oh boy, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It feels very, very well built universe.
Who's the bard? That's what I want to know.
That's Chris Pine's character.
He plays the bard. Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, this isn't the D&D podcast, but there's enough of those. Check out Critical Role. No, we are here to kick off Vampire Movie Month. And before we do that, we've got a little bit of movie news. And specifically, I found a story, or a story came across my app involving a new movie coming out with Danny Trejo and Tobin Bell starring in it. And I thought that's appropriate because we're talking about From Dusk Till Dawn in this episode. And of course, we will find out that Danny Trejo is in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming out in May, there is a new movie called The Curse of Wolf Mountain. Not The Curse of Wool Mountain. That's something else. The Curse of Wolf Mountain, starring Danny Trejo and Tobin Bell.
Is Tobin Bell not dead yet?
He's not dead yet.
I thought he was diagnosed with cancer, and then he had to go kill a bunch of people to teach him a lesson.
You're thinking of John Kramer, who looks a lot like Tobin Bell. Like, remarkably similar.
But you also got to remember, there's a lot of time fuckery, so this could be before all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We got to get back to the Saw franchise eventually. We are derelict in our duty.
Do we?
Her? I don't know. Her? No, not her. No, not her. That's a Joaquin Phoenix movie with Scarlett Johansson. Mm. But this one, The Curse of Wool Mountain, not Wool Mountain, Wolf Mountain, I said it again, centers on a AJ, who is a character not played by either of them, who begins to have vivid dreams of his parents' death. He decides to go back to the spot where they were killed 20 years ago, accompanied by his brother and his brother's family. But legend has it there's something mysterious roaming these woods.
Wait, so, his brother and his brother's family? That's his family.
Yeah. His extended family, I guess.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. JoeBlow.com. Get your reporting in order. So yeah, what do we think about Danny Trejo and Tobin Bell in a spooky, mysterious forest movie?
That is an interesting combo, I will say. But I like Danny Trejo.
He's just got like such a good vibe. And you can tell he's really grateful to be like a movie star. Like, he's not someone who I think takes it for granted. Like, he's come through some struggle and strife in his younger days, and now he's just like a fun, up for whatever movie star who gets to hang out and make people tacos sometimes. So I'm like, anything that Danny Trejo's in, I'm like, yeah, good for you, man, you rock.
I'm pretty sure he was also in the first, maybe the second, but the first season of Breaking Bad for a couple episodes.
He was
one of the drug runners, and then it was his head that was on the tortoise.
Two.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was season two, like once they started opening up the world a bit more.
And Hank was like doing the ice stuff, I think.
Yeah. He was working down on the border. And Danny Trejo was El Tortuga.
Tortuga.
Or La Tortuga or something. Yeah. So who's good?
Yes, Breaking Bad.
Yes, you have not seen the Breaking Bad, and that's okay. We don't force anybody to watch anything except for on this show. We watch a horror movie.
All right, for next week, I choose all five seasons of Breaking Bad.
Oh, all right. Fit it in with the vampire theme, Luke.
Married to Skyler is like being married to a vampire, right?
Oh, she gets served poorly.
I wouldn't say vampire is what she's like. She's more like a succubus, I would say.
Succubi?
Well, that'd be more than one succubus.
Mm. Yeah. Actually, speaking of that succubus, I saw a tweet today that was saying, is a joke tweet along the lines of a demonic summoner getting rid of the very gendered binary of succubi versus incubi and just calling it a fuckubus, which is...
fuckubi.
Fuckubi. Which is how some people's dates turn out. Fuck you.
Exactly. Bye. Yeah, fuck you. Bye.
All right. So then the other piece of movie news that I found, because I only found two this week, is one that piqued my interest because there's a movie coming out soon called Cold Storage, which stars Liam Neeson and Joe Keery from Stranger Things and Sosie Bacon, who was in Smile. And it centers around the plot as follows. Several decades ago, a highly infectious, constantly mutating microorganism capable of extinction-level destruction was contained in a military facility. In the present day, it has been sealed in the lowest sublevel, and it's like encased in the ice, but climate change is happening, temperatures raising underground, and these frozen samples are thawing out, and they risk getting out into the world and infecting everyone again. So I picked this one because I love when horror kind of like plays off of feelings of anxiety in the entire world. And I've heard a lot of times about people worried about climate change by having like, what if like stuff that's been frozen in the permafrost for generations and thousands of years comes back alive and our immune systems don't know how to fight it. So
that just sounds like the plot to Transformers.
The first one?
Mm-hmm. Isn't Megatron encased in a thing of ice?
In the water, like under the ocean.
That was
ice.
But after the first one, they drop him in the Mariana Trench, and then he comes back somehow. Mm. They're just like, he's back.
Okay.
But yeah, no, they find...
Yeah, never mind, it sounds like the thing.
It does sound like the thing as well. But it's not a parasite, it's just a virus, so...
Why would they not just destroy it? Why did they keep any samples?
Luke, have you ever watched Hoarders?
Yeah.
I know. Gain of function research.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they're like, well, maybe we'll just hang on to a little bit of it. Although it does say that the military bunker had been shut down and most of it has been sold off to a self-storage company. So maybe it is like an episode of Hoarders what was that show? They used to have a ton of those shows where it was like people would just go to storage units and bid on what was inside and then open it up. Well, that was like a million different types of those shows in the early 2010s. Property Stars, Pawn Stars, American Pickers.
Something like that. It was like on a...
Storage Wars?
It was on the History... Storage Wars. That's right.
Thank you, Luke.
It was on the History Channel, wasn't it?
That was actually just a guess.
Well, you are... I don't think you're wrong. That sounds very... That rings a big bell. So yeah, nice. Maybe it's just like somebody's like, I'll bid on what's in there, and they open it, and it's just a cloud of microbes. Oh, no.
Oh,
it got out somehow.
Oh, dang.
But yeah, I don't know. Liam Neeson. I'm always up for whatever he's doing. He seems to be working constantly. And Joe Keery, of course. We love him from Stranger Things.
Who did he play?
He was...
Steve.
Steve.
Oh, okay.
Steve with the good hair.
Yep.
Yeah. Any other opinions on that from what I've badly synopsized for you?
I mean, virus movies and shows are back in vogue.
That's true. I guess they took a couple years off for some reason. Can't remember why, but now they're back. Mm-hmm. Although there was one that came out in like, it was like either late 2020 or 2021 that Michael Bay had a hand in. And it was like the COVID-19 virus had mutated a bunch and it was like COVID-30 or something. And it was even more deadly. I remember that being a movie that came out and I was like,
well, that makes no sense because the 19 was just the year it developed.
Yes.
So
I know.
Was it a time traveling virus?
It was in the future. I don't know. It's Michael Bay. It probably transformed into a car at some point and then had a fart joke.
Have either of you seen Ambulance?
Uh-huh.
I still haven't checked it out.
Because that movie is fucking sick.
That was a good one, yeah. Everyone liked that one.
It was a little unbelievable. But it was fine. It had that sensibility of like, honestly, it reminded me a little bit of like Fast and Furious, the way that they talk.
Okay, yeah.
Like that was the kind of conversation style. But it was definitely entertaining.
Mm. Speaking of Fast and Furious, ahead of the D&D movie, there was a Fast 10 trailer.
Oh.
And it's not even, like, there's no plot at all. It's literally just shots of the characters in muscle cars. It's like Vin Diesel, Brie Larson is in it, Charlize Theron, Michelle Rodriguez. Like, just like people standing beside muscle cars for a minute, and then it's like Fast 10. It's like, oh.
Okay. I read there was an interview with Michelle Rodriguez where she was supposed to do like there's a fight scene in the movie with her and Charlize Theron, and mm-hmm. allegedly they were like, we're not going to rehearse this, let's just fight and roll the camera. So
cool.
I'm sure the editors are very happy with that.
Super easy for continuity. Mixing, yeah. But they're both like trained enough in stunts and action movies that they probably know how to put down the pieces of a
good these movies scene. Have made these people so rich.
God, no kidding.
Like, what other movies are any of these people in anymore? I guess Michelle Rodriguez is in Dungeons & Dragons, but like, I don't even know the last time I saw Vin Diesel in a movie that wasn't a Fast and Furious movie.
I mean, he's always credited as Groot for like Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff, but he's not in those movies. He just like sits in a recording booth and says, I am Groot.
When I think of Vin Diesel, I think of Fast and Furious and Pitch Black. That's like the only two. Mm-hmm. Well, he was also in Saving Private Ryan. He was the first one to die of the troop.
And Triple X. Triple X, of course. Sander Cage.
I actually never saw Triple X.
Nah, you're not missing anything. I think he just turned Fast and Furious into Triple X movies. Like, because Sander Cage was like some super spy who's like super good at tech and stuff. And that's just what the Fast and Furious movies are. Mm-hmm. But speaking of the Riddick, he's working on a fourth Chronicles of Riddick movie now. So
cool.
Anyway, that's been some random bits of movie news. So I reckon it's time to talk about the movie this week.
All right, let's go.
Okie dokie. So tell us what you picked for us to watch. We all know, but tell the listener. They also know, but tell us anyway.
I picked the 1996 Robert Rodriguez-directed film From Dusk Till Dawn, starring George Clooney and Quentin Tarantino, mostly because I'm not particularly inspired by vampire movies, so I wanted to find one that I would also probably enjoy beyond the vampire-ness of it. And, and more surprisingly than anything, I actually have never seen this film before, which is one of the kind of Annihilation-esque misses I have had in my cultural net over the years. I'd obviously heard tons about it. I kind of knew everything that it would be, and a little spoiler for my opinion, nothing of this movie surprised me. Fair. I knew kind of it's only tangentially horror, but I also... I'm aware that ship has sailed long ago for this podcast. So
it's a horror movie podcast.
It fit the bill more or less. And so, yeah. And I'd never seen it and I can't believe it. Mm-hmm. So I picked it.
Yeah. 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 I also hadn't seen it. I had heard a little bit about it. I was surprised at the cast list. Like, I didn't know even that George Clooney was in it until you like showed us, or you picked it for last week when you picked it. And like, I gotta say, like, there's a lot of people playing against type in a way that I was surprised by. I'm gonna save my thoughts for after the trailer, of course, but I think this one is this movie will hold the distinction on this podcast of giving me one of the biggest changes of heart, I think, from the first half to the second half of a movie. And so that's a little sizzle to get people to stick around after the trailer. And yeah, maybe not in a direction you'd think it might go, but we'll talk about it. But Alex, had you heard of this movie? Had you encountered this before this week?
Yeah, I remember watching this back in high school. and didn't remember like really too many details, just like, but then as I rewatched this, I was like, oh yeah, this was a thing. Oh yeah, I remember this. I think that was during my time where I just watched everything Tarantino / Tarantino adjacent related. Right. So yeah, this was one of them. So yeah, I have seen it before. I didn't remember too much about it until I started watching it. Then all the memories came flooding in about how, okay. How, what a romp, huh? Yeah, so that's my experience with it.
Oh boy, it's an interesting one to talk about. I think we should just go into it. But in terms of doesthedogdie.com, check out that for trigger warnings. There is a lot in this movie. This movie is kind of like two movies. Like, well, the first part is not a vampire movie, and then the second part is a lot of a vampire movie. But it, like, there's triggers around like language and talks about implied sexual violence, especially with around Quentin Tarantino's character of Richie.
Never trust a Richie, hey?
Never trust a Richie. There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of gore and viscera. The second half, there's a lot of just sort of like screaming and yelling and like putting people through emotional hell. But then there's also like a ton of just silly parts of this movie. This movie is like, again, it takes such a weird turn halfway through. But yeah, check out Does the Dog Die for any other trigger warnings and get your ears around this trailer.
Everybody be cool. You be cool. Somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
Low profile. You understand the meaning of the words low profile?
Sure. Two of America's most dangerous criminals have taken hostages.
What is this?
It's called a punch.
I'm going to ask you one question, and all I want is a yes or no answer. Do you want to live through this?
Yes.
Okay, ramblers, let's get rambling.
One night is all that stands between them and freedom.
This is my kind of place.
But it's going to be one hell of a night.
We might be in trouble. There are a bunch of fucking vampires out there trying to get in here and suck our fucking blood.
Now, their only chance is to fight back.
From Dusk Till Dawn is a 1996 American action horror film directed by Robert Rodriguez and written by Quentin Tarantino from a concept and story by Robert Kurtzman, starring Harvey Keitel, George Clooney, Quentin Tarantino, Ernest Liu, and Juliette Lewis. The plot follows a pair of American criminal brothers who take a family hostage in order to cross into Mexico, but ultimately find themselves trapped in a saloon frequented by vampires.
My God. There's a podcast. That's it. All right. So this movie was made for $19 million, and it has made $59.3 million. So that's why there's a lot. There's like a whole series of From Dusk Till Dawn. There's sequels and a TV show, and there's just like all sorts. But IMDb gives this one a 7.2, and Rotten Tomatoes has a 63% on this movie. So this one is deemed fresh. It's regarded as pretty positively, and I think there's probably a reason for that. But Luke Mason, give us those initial thoughts about From Dusk Till Dawn, 1996.
I think the easiest way to say it is that this is an entertaining, good, bad movie. You know, like this is a good, bad movie. It's not a good movie, but it's fun. I enjoyed it. There's so much kind of tangentially or secondarily around this film that makes it understandable as like this cultural totem, even if the movie itself is just ridiculous and nonsensical and like very offensive at times.
Oh boy.
I think predominantly the reason that this movie has this kind of charmed place in the cultural zeitgeist is because of the cast and the Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino-ness of it all. Because obviously, 1996, this is the immediate post Pulp Fiction world, which took the world by storm, that film. So Quentin Tarantino was like the hot new kid on the block. It wasn't even new. Like, he's established now. He's had two great films. And I think this is before Jackie Brown. And George Clooney was obviously a massive hit. But, like, I just, like, this, there's like a who's who of 90s stars.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. I didn't know Harvey Keitel was in this movie. The fact that Juliette Lewis was in this movie, too, is just such a bonus.
Right?
Danny Trejo, Cheech Marin. Yeah,
of course.
Salma Hayek. I kind of knew she was in it, but I sometimes mistake this movie with, like, Desperado, the Antonio Banderas film, you know? But, like, I think she's in both of them, so it doesn't really matter. And then there's, like, a few others. And, yeah, you watch this movie, and, you know, you get Evil Dead vibes, and you get, you know, this kind of over-the-top machismo offensiveness in the script. But I guess I just didn't care. Maybe we've just done so many bad, bad movies on this podcast that a good bad movie actually is quite satisfying at this point in time. And I saw the seedlings of Planet Terror in this, you know, like there's that, the dialogue and the kind of schlockiness of it all. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, I can see how this influenced his later film that was a little more famous. So this is not a good movie, but all things considered, I'm glad we did it and I enjoyed it. And it's fun. It'll probably be fun to talk about.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for that. I won't lie to you. The first 50 minutes of this movie, I was like, oh boy, are we going to have another Green Inferno on our hands? And once all the vampires started showing up, I was like completely turned around on this movie. Like all the stuff with Seth and Richie and just like the type of people they are, this like antisocial murderer, gangster, hoodlum types that just like they're like not fit for society. It's just like you should go to Mexico you should go to like some desert where you're around
get
zero people. just get in the bin. And like the whole part like in the motel with the like hostage, the kidnapping of Harvey Keitel's family, and like the interaction that Richie has with Juliette Lewis's character. But that was just like, it just put my teeth on edge. And then they get to the bar and then the vampires show up, and then it's just like, of course this guy's got a gun shaped like a cock and balls in his like codpiece. Of course Larry Williamson is here with his giant mustache and his giant arms, and he's gonna punch vampires and tear them apart. Like of course Harvey Keitel is gonna make a crucifix out of a shotgun and a bat and just like blow vampires away. Of fucking course that's gonna happen. And so like that whole last 40 minutes of this movie, I was just like, I'm in. I get it. I could do without the start. I don't care about
you started with the dusk, but you found the dawn.
Yeah. I don't know. No movie in my mind has done more to get me offside and then redeemed itself in my entire life. If you look at just the first half of this movie and say, would Billy like this movie? Then the answer is like, no, absolutely not. And then somehow it comes back. And I think a lot of it had to do with when they finally killed Quentin Tarantino's character. I was like, all right, that fucking psycho's gone. Good. We can enjoy this a bit more. But anyway, we can talk about all that more later because I want to get Alex's hot take. Your initial thoughts. What'd you think of From Dusk Till Dawn?
It's a very, very fun movie. You kind of just turn off your brain and watch it. But I think compared to the other kind of stupid movies, I thought it has that Tarantino dialogue touch to it where, you know, it's so obvious when you're watching a movie that he wrote because of the way people talk to each other and the conversations that they have. Which a lot, like, there's a lot of that in the first half, you know, when they're driving the RV to Mexico and Seth's just talking to Jacob at the front. And, you know, even the opening scene where that Texas Ranger or cop is talking to, the cashier.
Yeah.
So, like, I've always been a big Tarantino fan. I really enjoy his movies. I like the way he writes dialogue where it's just something super mundane, but the conversation is just so intriguing that, you know, you can't help but watch and listen and pay attention. Whereas other movies where it's like if two characters are just talking about something that is completely inconsequential to the plot, you kind of zone them out. So I think he's got such good skill to do that. So the first half of this movie I actually really liked because it's like, oh, this is a very interesting premise where you have these terrible, terrible characters and they're obviously written terribly for a reason. And it's kind of like Reservoir Dogs-esque where it's
Reservoir Doggies.
Reservoir Doggies. And, you know, they're like on the run from cops because they committed a crime. And then,
oh yeah,
it felt like, obviously it hasn't come out yet, but it felt very Hateful Eight-ish where there's like kind of a standoff in between characters. But it's at the same time, it's like, it's just, it's really kind of just stupid at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, but in a fun, playful way, which has that Robert Rodriguez twist to it, where he takes these concepts and ideas that and just makes it really dumb and zany, but also fun at the same time. So, like, when I think Robert Rodriguez, I think Spy Kids, because I have a ton of fond memories of Spy Kids as a kid growing up. So I think the combination of, like, his Tarantino's writing and Rodriguez's directing made actually the first half really intriguing and, like, captivating to me. And then all of that gets thrown out the window at the hour mark where, you know, that's when they finally meet the vampires. Mm-hmm. And I think the Tarantino writing part kind of gets lost, but the Rodriguez action, violence, and zaniness gets thrown in more. Mm-hmm. And because I like both of these two filmmakers quite a bit, this was just a very fun movie, even though it's like, you, like I said earlier, you just have to turn off your brain. You just have to accept what's going on as what's going on.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah. So I liked it.
There you go. All right. Complete. I think for me, the biggest surprise of this movie was just how, I guess, against type it seemed like all the characters were. Like, George Clooney being like a scumbag criminal is so not the picture I have when I think of George Clooney, because, like, my sort of earlier memories of George Clooney is like him as Danny Ocean, where he's like very suave and he's still a criminal, but he's like suave and
he's a gentleman, like, criminal.
He's exactly. He's a gentleman thief. He's like, looks very put together. And of course he's got this, like, this whole persona of him, like, after that I have in my head, where he's like, he's always like got like nice suits on and he's always dressed so well and he's always so poised. And that's just what I think of when I think of George Clooney. I don't think of him having a neck tattoo and him, like, just, like, shooting people and, like, kidnapping people and not caring about families and livelihoods and whatever. And I'm just like, so it was such a, like, it spun my head around to be like, oh, this is not George Clooney. This is not how I think. But, like, that's a testament to maybe his acting ability. And same, too, with Harvey Keitel, because, again, my familiarity with him is from Tarantino, and he's people like the Wolf in Pulp Fiction, where he's like a cold, heartless, analytical type. And just to have him be like a family man with a beard, I was just like, what? That's not Harvey Keitel. What's going on? Like, it's so just like the way the characters were portrayed was so.
Well, and Juliette Lewis was famous for being like a rampant murderer prior to this film. You know, now she's like the sweet kid. Because she was
what
in
movie was she?
Natural Born Killers.
Oh, really? Okay.
With which I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that came out before this film. But we
It was 94.
Yeah. So, okay. So on that point, like, the character, the cast, I think this is really crucial as to why a lot of people like this movie, all of the things that happen in it, notwithstanding, is that, you know, I reflect a little bit on when I came of age. Mm-hmm. So in grade 11, when I was, I think I just turned 17, I took a class called Drama, Film, and Television in high school. And that was really my kind of blossoming into understanding film at a deeper level, not just as pure entertainment or Disney or whatever. Now, part of that was also because I was pretty, I suppose the right word would be repressed in my movie allowance growing up, because a lot of movies have latent Satanism, as we've described before, and you can't unsee that shit. So I just hadn't been exposed to a lot of new, unique, great filmmaking until that class. And some of the formative films that were talked about and I got to watch for the first time that era was definitely Reservoir Dogs, definitely Pulp Fiction, and definitely Natural Born Killers. So my attachment to the Harvey Keitels and the Juliette Lewis's are very formative to me in my appreciation of great films, which is kind of why I was a surprise I'd never seen this one. And so in a similar way, I think we talked about with I Know What You Did Last Summer, the movie, that movie's ridiculous, but we have a nostalgia for the cast. Every time I see Harvey Keitel in anything, I remember Reservoir Dogs, and I remember how fucking great that movie is. And then I'm like, oh, okay. Well, if he chose to be in this movie, there's some merit in it somewhere. Because of what he's done before. You know, it's kind of like how you meet a new person and you're not really sure, but you give them the benefit of the doubt because they're friends with a friend. So you, like, trust your friend's judgment a little bit. And this movie just had that saturation of Danny Trejo. And obviously this is anachronistic, but like Machete is such a great film. And the whole idea of Machete is just so awesome, you know? So I love Danny Trejo. Cheech Marin, my first exposure to him was when he and Tommy Chong appeared in South Park, like season 4. There's a very seminal episode where Cheech and Chong are in South Park. I have attachments to all of these actors and actresses that have nothing to do from Dusk Till Dawn, but kind of holistically do, I suppose. And so there's a anti-charm to this film with the characters that I think is part of what makes it punch above its weight given the content of the film, if that makes sense.
Right. Right. And I think the movie, like I said, it redeems itself once Quentin Tarantino's character dies because he gets killed by the vampires and then turns into a vampire and then gets... Anyway. And I think that's a smart call because of the two brothers, even though they're both like reprehensible, antisocial people in society, Richie is magnitudes worse than Seth.
Seth's still got a code.
Seth has a code. Richie is like... completely unhinged. And I think that if you know, because obviously some people have to walk away, and the only people that survive this encounter from Dusk Till Dawn are Juliette Lewis and George Clooney. And I think that if they had made both the brothers survive all the way to the end, it would have been like, no, I don't want to see this person. I don't want to see Richie win. I don't want to see the Richies of the world win and be successful. Like, I want them to be fed their just desserts because they have committed atrocities. And I really like the, I don't know, this the taste of the time. Maybe it's a commentary on the news cycle, but when he's like watching the news of the brothers like escape, it like puts up on the news report like the number of people that he's killed, where it's like 5 police officers, 6 Texas Rangers, and 7 civilians. And it's just like, what? Like, this isn't like, you don't need to report that on the news, like a tally count of what he's doing. And so,
and then you think about it, it's like, that's what they do on the news.
Of course, that is. Like, that's what happens on cable news, I guess. Yeah, so to have him going, like, of the duo of, like, Robert Rodriguez? Yeah. Quentin Tarantino. Like, I'm more familiar with Tarantino stuff. Like, I've seen Reservoir Dogs. I've seen Pulp Fiction and Inglourious Basterds. I just rewatched that one recently. You know, those are engrossing movies, and you love to hear the people talk, and you know, like you're drawn in, like Alex, you said. But I don't know much about Robert Rodriguez. Like, I didn't know that they had worked together on so many things. It was a surprise to me to see Quentin Tarantino's like little Easter eggs of like the Red Apple cigarettes, which is like what he has in all like the movies he works in, and then like Big Kahuna Burger shows up as a little like, oh, if you know, you know. And so I knew that they had done like Death Proof and Planet Terror, kind of like had they worked together, but I didn't know that their relationship was so interwoven that Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino had worked together so much. So I feel like I maybe need to check out some of the Robert Rodriguez canon to fill that picture in a little bit more. But I don't really know where I was going with that. Just to say, like, I'm lacking in that. Side.
This movie kind of sneaks up on everybody, I think, because it's not the most famous movie in the corpus of very famous people, right? And that's always kind of juicy, you know. In trivia, for example, I always like to play a only moderately or not so famous song by a famous band. You know what I mean? So it's like everyone knows the kind of meta-ness of it, but what's the specific? And I think there's an itch that this movie scratches in that way. I don't think this would be a fun movie to watch as the first movie you watch in the Tarantino Rodriguez. Like, you need to know how good you need to know how good Tarantino is as a filmmaker to appreciate how horrible he is in this movie. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you kind of need that meta awareness of his oeuvre to appreciate the writing in this, I think.
You need to know about his very public foot fetish to really appreciate this movie.
That's right.
Right? It's just perfect that he's the one that writes it, and he's the one that gets to drink off of, you know,
Selma Hayek's foot.
It's perfect. It's so funny in so many different levels. And then, you know, I think, like, I didn't quite understand that scene as much when I first watched it in high school, because, like, I wasn't... Like, I had watched Tarantino movies, but I didn't, I didn't realize how much of a foot fetish this guy had. But, like, now, rewatching it, it's like, you can see in every single movie that he's ever made, like, there's some kind of foot thing, because obviously he likes feet.
Yeah, you can't unsee it. Which, like, okay, so that is something that I noticed while watching this movie. Obviously, you can't, it's literally shoved in your face. But I know that, like, I mentioned that everyone's sort of playing really against type, and so it was, I think, the hardest for me to, like, deal with Richie's characterization, because Quentin Tarantino is so, it's well known about this foot fetish thing that he has. And it's like, it's, fetishes are fine, kinks are fine, we're not kink shaming anybody, but it's just like it's so in your face, and it's like, you so know about it, it just feels like, oh, if you wrote it, like, of course you wrote this for you. And so it's just like, I don't want to see you getting off on, like, the thing that's, like, your you know, your big kink on a film that I'm not prepared for. Like, if you want to engage with, like, kink stuff or fetish stuff, you kind of seek that out and you know what you're getting into. And maybe you should know that getting into a Quentin Tarantino movie, but it's also like, my guy, you don't have to. You can just keep it down.
At this point, it's like, it's his thing, right?
Yeah. It's his thing, but it's still,
it's
like,
kind of like, what's his name? Conjuring guy.
Patrick Wilson?
No, Patrick. Director.
James Wan.
James Wan.
James, it's James Wan's, camera shot, yeah, where he flips.
I'll take
shit.
A million spitting James Wan camera shots, because I don't think James Wan is, like, jerking off to those, but I feel like Quentin Tarantino might jerk off to his own movies.
Yeah, I guess that point would, for ethics, that point would come down to, like, how informed and willing the actresses are to participate in those scenes.
Yes.
And that's, like, a much bigger question of, obviously, that was kind of, like, the genesis of the Me Too movement, is, like, a lot of that shit was pretty underhanded and untoward. Mm-hmm. But, like, also, in... I don't even think this is a defense of Tarantino. It's more like a notion about higher level art and filmmaking, is that people need to be pretty aware that, and I'm sure they are, that movies and writing traipse across the entirety of the human condition and the human experience. And a lot of that is pretty gross. So,
yeah, I think of the foot scenes in this movie, that one where Selma Hayek pouring whiskey down her leg into his mouth is less offensive to me than is the one where it's just like a close up on Juliet Lewis's feet, where she's just sitting and he's just, like, staring at her. Because I looked it up, because I was like, ooh, this is weird. She was 23 when this movie was made, so she was an adult, and I hope they had the conversation with her. But the character is definitely underage and a minor, and just to, like, have those scenes where, like, there's this very predatory character of Richie who is, like, it's like, if he's left alone with her for long enough, he is, it's not a matter of if he will assault her. It's
yeah, exactly.
Certainty. Well,
I would humbly submit to you, Billy, that this movie actually did its job with you by making you uncomfortable and disliking of Richie. Like, this movie is not celebrating the Richies of the world. It is very much the opposite of that. And, like, that's depth of writing, is to be able to write villains or anti-heroes or quote-unquote bad people in a way that is thoughtful and thought-provoking, even in a movie as schlocky as this one, where it's like, yeah, fuck you, Richie, you're gonna get what's coming to you. And then, of course, he does, you know. And it's such a perfect,
so,
like,
great.
Before he gets killed or turned, it's a perfect power shift, right? Selma Hayek has all the power in that situation, and Richie has none of it. And so, you know, I'm not going to go so far as to say it's, like, a really powerful feminist moment, but it's kind of like, it's certainly more femdom than anything. You know?
We love to see a girl boss winning.
And Selma Hayek makes a pretty good girl boss. I'm just going to say it.
Boy, oh boy.
I got big Dogma vibes, too. That's another movie. Dogma was a huge movie in my formative recollection, and she's like a go-go dancer in that one, too.
Yeah, I think the only thing I knew from Dusk Till Dawn was, like, there is a scene where Selma Hayek dances with a snake, and that is something that that rang a bell pop culturally in my mind earlier on, that I can't place where I know it from, but I know I've seen other properties reference the snake scene in this movie. But let's talk about Seth Gecko, George Clooney's character, especially the characterization of him being the one who's like, we got to play it cool. We don't want to, like, let's not get anyone hurt. Like, he's so mad at Richie when he, like, shoots.
No murdering and no raping.
He, like, he gets so mad at Richie when he shoots the Texas Ranger in the gas station and then, like, sets everything on fire. And he's like, you got to control yourself. You got to control yourself. But in fact, when they get to the bar, it's him who, like, loses his cool because the bouncer is a jerk to him. And I think Harvey Keitel, Jacob, he has a thing where he's like, what the fuck is your problem? Like, you've already won. Why can't you just shut up about this?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is in this movie, which took me completely by surprise, an interesting sort of psychological analysis of a person who is like, you don't know when you've won. So, like, what will make you happy? And I want to just dig down.
Chekhov's Jungian shadow, hey?
I guess so, yeah.
Well, I think Seth Gecko is one of those characters where I felt it was quite ahead of its time. I thought he was someone that always wants to play the victim, no matter what situation. And that's such a tell of society nowadays. Every motherfucker in this world always wants to be oppressed so fucking bad, wants to be a victim so fucking bad, when they have it so good, you know? Every little thing is like, oh, like, this great injustice is done upon me, and I need to, and then people react in different ways, obviously, with Seth being, I'm gonna beat the shit out of someone, I'm gonna kill them. You know, there's other ways to do it, but, like, the kind of, like, victim complex that I thought he had was just so telling of what, I'm gonna say Western society is nowadays, because, you know, we have it so fucking good compared to other places in the world, and we just want to be the victim all the time, right? And, you know, there are great injustices done upon us, upon some people in Western society. That's not, like, to take away from that. But, like, when your entire identity is about being a victim, it's, like, it fucking...
Yeah. And he's, like, he's very, like, obviously there's something that is in this guy's soul or his character where he has got trauma so bad that he just... I don't know if it's self-destructive. We talked about this in Annihilation last week. This is our self-destructive arc that we're talking about on this. But, like, yeah, he can't be happy with it. And, like, I don't know what it is. I don't know. I haven't done enough psychology classes to really speak on it with any measure of expertise. But it's very fascinating to have him be like, yeah. I mean, granted, it comes out in the movie that the guy who told him to go to this bar didn't know it was a vampire bar. So it was just like, from all the information they had, once they get to that bar, if you just, like, shut up and sit down with your mouth shut and drink your whiskey and wait until the sun comes up, you did it.
Because you never know who's got a cock gun.
that got me thinking, though, right? Let's say they just sat there and didn't do anything and didn't get into fights. They would have still been attacked by the vampires anyway, right?
Yes. I think they would have still been attacked by the vampires, but the point is they didn't know it was vampires until it was vampires. But
Seth would have been happier with his sense of being.
Right.
Right, like, that's kind of, like, to marry the two points, the social and the psychological that you both just made, like, the social, Alex, of, like, annoying victimhood. But I think and that's true, like, I think we can all kind of understand and relate to the feeling of what it's like to be around someone who's a bit too complainy, who's a bit too self-involved in their own grievances, and maybe talks about them as they talk about it more, the degree of grievance seems to be smaller. I think we all kind of have been around people like that in life, and probably we've all been those people at times. And but what I think is the real revelation is, like, not only is that kind of attitude or way of being bad for the people around you, what Harvey Keitel's character is trying to tell us, it's also really bad for you, right? Like, it's not just bad for us that you're like this. It's actually going to make your life worse if you're like this. If you want your life to be better, and this is, like, very much in line with what I know from, like, cognitive behavioral therapy and clinical psychology, is, like, no, you actually get more meaning out of your life if you can, and not to trivialize any real trauma, but, like, if you can get the better of it. Like, that is actually what will make you feel better about your own life. So it's not just third-person social benefit if you're not a, you know, a whiny little bitch. It's actually first-person psychological resilient better if you can overcome that stuff too. And I think that that's, like, the more positive spin, because it's, yeah, obviously it's easy to be noticing when other people are annoying. I think that human beings are well documented in noticing those things. But to me, the real insight is like, well, it's actually also not good for you in the long span of your life. And that, and you know, again, that kind of insight is not something you see coming in this kind of film.
Which, boy oh boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I guess of all the characters in the movie, maybe he has the most of what you might classify as an arc.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's just like, he starts out being like, I won't ask him for or why the rate is 30%, to at the end of the movie, he negotiates a little bit. And mm-hmm. it's like, ah, oh, Seth has grown as a person.
Yeah. Well, we went through an unforeseen externality.
We went through a real situation. So I think we got to talk about the bar, the gore, the vampires, the effects. I will say for 1996, the effects of these vampires and the prosthetics, they weren't bad. I thought they were pretty good. Even the vampire death sort of dissolving thing was pretty good for the time. There's a lot of rubber suits and a lot of latex masks, but
a lot of leather daddies.
A lot of leather daddies.
I want something that says daddy likes leather. Oh, a leather daddy. Oh, there is such a thing.
Do you mean leather daddy? Yeah. Thanks, Tobias. I bet you Sex Machine got his gear at that same place that Tobias did. Because, dear listener, there's a character in this movie whose name and is credited as Sex Machine.
I'm assuming that's the guy with the cock gun.
Yes.
Yes.
His name is Sex Machine. Tom Savini.
I can see it. I can see it.
Yeah. Well, they have it. They have a scene where it's like after most of the bikers have been killed, they get rid of all the, I think, the dancers and the, obviously Selma Hayek is like the lead vampire, as well as Danny Trejo and the bouncer and Cheech Marin. They get rid of all that. And then Juliette Lewis is like, introduces herself to him and asks him his name is. And he's just like, I'm Sex Machine. That's it. That's it. That's all. That's his whole name. You're talking to a child, but that's okay. You're going to be like, this is my name. I'm Sex Machine. What do you want from me?
Yep.
The whole action sequence of them killing vampires, I thought, was where this movie was funniest and silliest. There's a scene where a man rips a vampire's heart out of his chest, stares at it for a long time, has another character come over and look at it and investigate it. The vampire, meanwhile, does nothing. And then very just like casually, it gets stabbed with a pencil, and that's how they kill this vampire, which is just like, okay.
Okay. Parenthetical here. If, hypothetically, if you are a band of vampires,
yes,
and you are terrorizing people, don't do it in a bar full of pool cues. This is like death traps cues everywhere for vampires. How quickly did all of those survivors know what to do? Like, it took a second. Break the pool cue, stab him in the heart. I don't know. If I were going to terrorize a group of people, I wouldn't do it in a place, and I'm an immortal being, except for a few things. I'm not just going to put all the things that can kill me right around the people who would otherwise stop me, right? I don't know. It's not my business. I'm not a vampire killing expert in terms of being the vampire, sucking the blood. I just think I would bring that up at the committee meeting of being like, well, this seems a little stupid, doesn't it?
Well, Luke, you might ask that, and I feel like you might get a rebuttal to your problem, which is them to say that, like, we're vampires, which in this universe means we're real squishy, because we can be killed by chair legs or table legs or things that are not even steak-shaped, so it doesn't matter.
Well,
like,
well,
let's
don't make
worry
sure
about
we,
it.
Let's make sure we maximize all of those items in this bar where we are.
Yeah. Yeah, the inevitable point of this movie that talks about, like, what kills a vampire, I thought was great. Like, we always have to have that. We always have to see, like, what lore is real for this movie and what is just storytelling. The fact that the vampires, when they turn, their bodies get really, really soft and can be torn apart like rag dolls was just very funny to me. Like, they have a whole scene where Tom Savini, who is Sex Machine, is, like, touching Fred Williamson, I don't know what character he played, but he's like, look how strong you are. And he's like touching all his muscles. And he's like, but vampires are soft and squishy. And so it's like, okay, I love that establishing of the rules. I love the question of, like, does silver work on vampires? And they debate it for a second until Juliet Lewis is like, do we have any silver on us? No? Then who cares? I was just like, that was the biggest laugh of the movie for me. Just like, who cares?
A little known, Juliet Lewis is quite the pragmatist.
Yeah. Just then who cares? Like, let's focus on what we do have. Yeah.
Is it a live option? No. Fuck off.
We don't need to talk about it. So yeah, but what did you think about the kills and the gore, Alex? Let's hear your thoughts too.
It's fun. It was fun. There was I remember this interview that Tarantino once did, and I think this is what I like and respect so much about Tarantino, is like, he's committed so much to the art of it all. Mm-hmm. So yes. I think there was this one interview, I don't remember who it was and what movie it was specifically, but it was like, do you think all this violence is unnecessary, or like all this gore, like something like probably to the extent of like, can't you think of the kids? And he's like, no, it's fun. Like, because it's awesome, right? Yeah. That's what I got from this movie. It's like, yeah, it's excessive, it's bloody, it's stupid, but it's fun. Who cares?
Don't let your kids watch movie. It.
Yeah, don't let your kids watch it if you don't want them to being exposed to this kind of stuff, right? So it was just every single way that you can kill a vampire was like shown based off of what they had, right?
Yeah, we want to see it all.
Holy water balloons. I thought he was filling up condoms at first.
They were condoms.
They were condoms. I thought they were water balloons.
No, they were condoms, but they broke like water balloons. They were not a good brand of condoms to get. Condoms shouldn't break that easy.
Yeah, and then the fucking like the super soaker with holy water.
Yeah.
It was just it's just fun. Like it was a movie where I'm sure they had so much fun filming.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Totally. I think they had a lot of fun with the kills and so it looked, yeah.
And the practical effects, especially during the death, like, it's obviously not the same because in Planet Terror there's zombies, but that's where I got a lot of like, oh yeah, okay, I see where the effects and some of this over the top viscera from Planet Terror came from, you know, and like and even just the crazy weapons being used, like in Planet Terror when Rose McGowan gets a rifle on her leg because she loses her leg, so she just gets a gun and it has a rocket propelled element to it too. And, you know, it's not the same, but like the cock gun and the shotgun crucifix, like it's just like zany weapons to fight these crazy monsters. What is potentially lost in analysis because this movie is so crazy is just the imagination that goes into this kind of movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's so impressive what the minds of, you know, Tarantino and Rodriguez and whoever wrote the short story came up with too. Because it's just so like, of course, like you got this traditional lore about vampires and what kills them, but you have modernity now. So you have different little weapons or things you can use and like in a sense, kind of loophole weapons to get, you know, and of course, well, look, just totally convenient that Harvey Keitel happens to be a pastor. So he can bless the holy water, even though I don't think he's Catholic, which is another little wrinkle in all of this, but whatever.
Doesn't matter. He's a man of God.
Exactly.
We've established that it's like the level of faith that matters, not the type of faith, really. Yeah. Like it's like your amount.
Well, and then that's like another kind of like fairly deep theme that you wouldn't expect out of this movie is like someone that loses their faith because their wife dies in this tragic accident.
Yes, yeah.
Right? And then has to somehow regain it because they're in a life and death situation. And then, like, comes to a point where it's like, yeah, like, when I turn, you need to kill me. So we got a bit of, like euthanasia going on as well.
Yes. Surprisingly.
I used to teach youth in Asia.
You did, yeah.
Because you worked in South Korea.
That's right.
I wrote a note down just to go, I didn't realize that Planet Terror was a zombie movie, Luke, and just to go off that note, I had the thought where I was like, this movie feels like they don't know if it's a vampire movie or a zombie movie, just because they have that like first wave where it's all the dancers and Selma Hayek and the people who own the bar, and then they kill all the truckers and bikers except for like the core thing, and then they all start animating and you're like, oh wait, that's just how it works with these vampires. They can just like come back like zombies. So I was just like, did you accidentally want to make a zombie movie, Robert Rodriguez? And
well, then he on purposely did.
That makes sense that Planet Terror is. Yeah. Yeah. And there's like three waves, you know, it's like the first wave, the second wave is all the bar denizens. And then you got to get rid of, you know, your characters who've been bitten in turn, and then you just get like a million bats that turn into vampires, which is like, I guess when vampires die in this movie, it's like how wasps have like pheromones they sent out. If like the nest is threatened, they like release pheromones and it like draws other wasps to it. That's how the other vampires came. Kill everyone. But I feel like this sex this machine didn't.
This would have been a great movie for us to watch. This is the kind of movie that really makes me miss the in-person recordings. Because,
yeah,
like, this just so. Would have... This is a perfect Mystery Science Theater 3000 type of movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And but it knows it, right? Like, when these movies are self-aware of all of that stuff, that's what makes it a good bad movie, you know, is the self-awareness of it.
Okay, I want to talk about one specific kill. That was like the most surprising. And it's around our very favorite character, Sex Machine, of course.
Which, of course.
So he gets bit early on, and then he does that thing where he doesn't tell people until it's like too late, and he turns. But later on, he gets his head whipped off because, of course, he's the type of person who comes to a bar with a bullwhip. Sure. A man's got, he's got a gun for a penis. I don't really have any questions about his life choices.
Sex Machine. After that. Whips required.
Yeah. But then, when he gets his head pulled off, he just, like, transforms into a giant rat. Like, what did we think that was? Was that a werewolf? Was that a giant? Like, what was going on with that part? Aside from it looking cool. Is this, like, again, the point you made about imagination and just seeing what was on the screen?
I just interpreted that as a genre joke.
Right. Yeah. Oh, okay. So kind of like Fright Night?
Well, it's like, okay, here's a movie about vampires, but here's a werewolf, because we all know werewolves and vampires are also kind of like the same thing, but different, but enemies, and but so here's a werewolf for you. Ha ha ha.
Ha ha. Okay. That looked pretty good. Like, for what it was, it didn't look bad. I thought it was kind of cool effects. It was real slimy. It was real gross. But yeah. What did you think about the rat? Or did you think it was a rat or a wolf, Alex?
I don't know, because anytime we see werewolves in these horror movies, they kind of look a bit like that. Like Trick or Treat.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, yeah, right.
They were werewolves, and they looked like a bit like that. They weren't like all the werewolves that I see in movies. They're not like they're not hairy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they look kind of like those weird furless cats. What are those called?
Sphinx cats.
Sphinx cats. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, the transformation was a little jarring. I was like, why the fuck is he a dog rat right now?
Hail Ratma,
but...
Hail Ratma. Oh, that's what it was.
But, yeah, I was like, I didn't think too much more about it after he died, because it's like, okay, like, whenever someone... Like, anytime someone dies in this movie, you instantly forget about him, right?
Yeah.
Like, once Richie died, I didn't think about him at all.
He's gone.
Yeah, Like, there's so much happening that you're really only focused on who's alive,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, as soon as, what's the son's name? Scott?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, once Scott died, I was like, oh, like.
Bye, Scott.
There goes my representation.
He was great, too, man. He was awesome.
Yeah, he was fine. And, like, there's so many, like, cool, tense moments in this movie. Like, when they're on the border, and he's having the conversation with Jacob. Like if you don't tell them, I'm going to tell them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? And then it's just like, it's a very quick, like 40-second scene of the two of them just like arguing whether or not they should tell the border police that, you know, they got Seth and Richie in the back. But it's like so much tension and like really cool kind of like, it made me think of like Inglourious Basterds when it's revealed that there's the family hiding underneath the floorboards in the opening scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just so, ratchets the tension up real high. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that relationship was like actually played really well between Harvey Keitel and Juliette Lewis and Eugene Liu, I think his name was.
Yeah.
They give you enough to like get you on board with what their whole deal is, and they don't like, they don't belabor the point, which they could have done. I feel like if they had, we get his exposition about the wife dying in the car accident and how that's tough. But like, I really liked the way their family worked together, and it was just like wholesome. And again, totally against type, because I don't see Harvey Keitel as a family man. I don't see Juliette Lewis as like a good sort of like, you know, goody two shoes type kid. Maybe because I just watched Yellow Jackets season one and she is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
But it was good. But yeah, forgettable when they die. What else do I want to say? Why do we think Fred Williamson told a 3-minute long Vietnam story. Just to
well, because you know,
what was that about?
A lot of shit went down in Vietnam.
A lot of shit, but like, buddy, this is not the time. It's not the time for your story. With like, he's like acting it out and like doing poses at what is happening.
Well, I mean, and I think that all that plays into the kind of duality of this film, which is like what's happening in the movie and what's happening to the audience watching this movie, which are two different things, right? And so like a lot, sometimes my favorite movies are when it is just a straight, like a story that you can be absorbed in. But I do enjoy mm-hmm. the humor of like, you know, this movie is still in the era where the 80s action films are still kind of around, you know? So like Predator and Commando sure. and Rambo, like all those kind of movies are still zeitgeisty, right? And so mm-hmm. to have that kind of goofy archetype of that, like it's a little bit of a satire, I think, on those kind of type of movies.
Maybe Fred Williamson shares your ethos, Luke, of like, it's not that you're telling a joke. It's just how cavalier you can be with people's time.
Exactly.
And that's what is enjoyable exactly. to you. And so he's just doing that. He's like, you're going to listen to me. I don't care. I'm going to tell this story. Yeah. It's fine. I will say that the vampire swarm held really strongly to the rule of there's only one level of ninja power. So it's like, you know, if you're fighting one-on-one ninja, then you're equally strong. But if it's one ninja versus a lot of ninjas, then all those ninjas have to share the abilities of one, because these vampires, like the more there were, the worse they got at being vampires.
Yeah.
Like if it was like a one-on-one fight, it was equally matched. But at the end, it's like these four people, there's like 80 to 100 vampires and they don't do anything. They're just running around in the background. Like it's crazy.
Well, it almost feels like they know they're in a movie and they're not the heroes.
Almost. Yeah. it's just like, I was like, okay, yeah, no, they need to be action, you know, fodder, because they're just gonna explode, and one squirt of holy water will light them on fire or explode them, whatever looks cooler in this shot. I thought it was just very funny to see these vampires that they've done this whole thing of killing these truckers and bikers for who knows how long and never been found out, and then it's just like one angry psychopath, his brother, and some people he kidnapped is enough to, like, take it down.
And then the reveal at the very end that it's, like, some Aztec temple yeah. in
yes.
the back.
Yeah. Nobody... I guess this was a time before Google Maps, but, like, that doesn't last into today.
Yeah.
Just, like, nobody went around the back. Nobody looked... Nobody went, like, to the side.
No, because as a... Was it a... Whatever Cheech's character was called. It's like, I drove by it a couple times.
It seemed fine, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's hard to believe Sex Machine didn't even find the back door.
What did he think was... What does this man think? He's like, he gets up in the morning and he's like, leather, I got my whip, just in case I need to steal beers. I got my gun, codpiece. I'm looking good, I'm ready. Like, I'm ready to take on the day.
Just, hey, you know, okay. I know this movie, that part is set in Mexico, but America is a hell of a place, Billy.
I guess so. How does he cross the border? Anything to declare? Just this gun that is my dick. Okay.
I have to say, I don't think it's as hard to get into Mexico as it is to get into the United States.
I guess so. Yep. Man, maybe that's true. Especially in a pre-9/11 world. Oh, boy.
I mean, in No Country for Old Men, Josh Brolin just walks into Mexico to get some medical help, you know, and when he comes back into America, all he has, well, I mean, it's a lot harder and the guy's a dick, but he convinces him because they were both in Vietnam. So it's like, hoorah, you're welcome back. And, you know,
that's why he told the story.
God, that is such a great scene, too. That's an underrated scene in that great film.
In No Country for Old Men?
Yeah. Is his interaction with the border guard. It's a really cool scene.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I saw it once.
Do yourself a favor.
I saw it pretty recently, like 2 months ago.
Oh my God, it's so good.
It's good.
All right. Do we want to talk about this movie anymore? Do we have any final thoughts? Luke, have you got a final thoughts for this one?
Yeah, I mean, like, as the two of you know, my favorite kind of movie is one that isn't tongue-in-cheek, I suppose. So, like... To me, the greatest George Clooney film is Michael Clayton from 2007. And the reason
the greatest is Michael Clayton.
I think that's his best movie. I think that's the best movie he's in. Maybe his best role, maybe not, because there's a few other people who really stand out in that film too. But like that movie is a tense thriller that is an entirely self-contained story with fidelity to reality. You know, that's my favorite kind of movie because it's really, I think that's the hardest to make, is a compelling story. But this movie, I also like this genre, which is like meta-aware, a little like kind of on purposely self-indulgent. And I really wished, my only regret is that we didn't watch it together because it would have been a super fun one to watch together.
It would have been fun to watch together. Of course, Michael Clayton is fine. But as you know, the greatest George Clooney performance is Fantastic Mr. Fox.
That's, of course.
That's yes. The best one.
That's true. We all know
he's
that.
Good in that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. He's
and
great.
Of course,
like, he's one of the best. Batman. He's one of the best.
He's one of the best. He's one of the best. I really like him in the Nespresso commercials he does.
Yeah.
Those are fun. He's doing a lot of that. Alex, have you got final thoughts?
No, just I like the first half more than the second half, but when the second half came on, I wasn't complaining.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, I think my final thought is I don't think I've been so divided on a movie based on the act breaks of it and the running time of it. Every minute before the vampire showed up, I was not into it. But then once the vampire showed up, it really turned it around. If you could watch my like star rating or my rating of this movie, if there was a graph like based on like the minute, it would like start high because I always start high. It would crater. And then at like the minute 60 mark, it just like climbs back up out of that crater. So this movie, it was a ride. I will say that it was a ride. It definitely took me on a roller coaster ride. So yeah, so far there's been no fire alarm this week, so that's great. But let's talk about the scariest part of the movie. And Luke, I would like you to start.
I mean, this movie is manifestly non-scary. Even the monsters are ridiculous. So I would say, for me personally, the scariest part is that big-ass snake, because I hate snakes. And so just the idea of having a big-ass snake around your neck and holding it, like, I get clammy and uncomfortable when I see pictures of people with snakes around holding snakes. Whatever that primal evolutionary thing that keeps you noticing that snake in the grass type of thing, it's like, get the fucking snake out of here.
Oh wow, okay. So snakes for you, rats for Alex. I'm not great with spiders, so that's
the trifecta.
That's like the big three. So that's your scariest part.
Yeah.
I think my scariest part of the movie is, yeah, like the vampire stuff. There's no jump scares. It's the gore is so cartoonish that it is not like scary at all. I think just the scene in this first half of the movie where they have their hostage, Gloria, this like nice sort of office lady, and she's alone with Richie. And then Seth comes back with the burgers and he's like killed her. I was just like, oh no, this is... Seth, you got to get rid of Richie. Get rid of him. It's no good for you. I know he's your brother, but just cut ties, man.
Yeah, he's a liability, and you know it.
And you have seen it. You have evidence for this. Yes, he broke you out of prison, but what has he done for you lately? Not a lot. So, like, just that part.
Again, that's just such a hilarious plot point to just throw in, because as we learned, how the fuck did Richie possibly pull off a rescue from
prison break?
He's such a useless person. How did he pull this off?
Yeah, there's no way he
has... Wild card, bitches.
Yeah, I guess so. Just that like sort of dumb naivety where you're like, I will be able to go through this because there's no way I could possibly fail. And you just like flop your way through it.
It's the same kind of dumb joke that I love in the first few Scream movies with Ghostface, where he's this clinical, on top of everything killer. But every time you see him, mm-hmm. he's falling down and can't stand and like is flying downstairs. He's just slapstick ridiculousness that is supposedly pulling off these really intricate murders when he's not on screen. Just love that discordance of character type between exposition and manifestation is delicious to me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And Richie's a good example of that in this film.
Absolutely. So what's your scariest part, Alex?
Probably the border crossing. It's like at that point you're definitely like not rooting for Seth and Richie, but there's the dilemma like, oh, like if they like, we want them to get found, but I don't want them to get found because if they get found, you know, family's probably going to be collateral. Yeah, it was a tense moment.
Yeah, it was very tense. And then it's compounded by the end where it's like, yeah, Seth gets to go off into Mexico. He's got his Carlos and he just leaves Juliette Lewis there. He's like, okay, well, bye. I was just like, what's going to happen to her? She's
gave her some money. She could drive.
Some money. Does she have a class 2 license?
I really liked that ending because yeah. It does weirdly show Seth Gecko's growth where he's like, no, I'm keeping my word. You're not going to be my prisoner. I'm not going to kill you. You know, like I'm changing my ways a little bit, or at least I have my honor code where, you know, like you've served your purpose and I appreciate you. So here's some money and fuck off.
Goodbye.
I thought it was great.
Not my problem anymore.
In that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But I was just, what happens to her next? That is the question I was left with at the first
point. She drive back home.
Just drive back home. Yeah.
She's rich now. She'll be fine.
Right. She's Juliette Lewis. She'll land on her feet. Okie dokie. Then we got to rate this one and we got to rate it out of something. And boy, oh boy, Luke, I don't know what you're going to pick.
Well, there's many things that I could choose that I think would get a chuckle out of the two of you. But I think the most obvious one is we got to rate this out of 5 titty twisters.
We had avoided saying the name of the bar until this point.
And
but yes,
the sign.
It is called
the sign is just someone tweaking a nipple. Like, it's just too funny.
My God.
So we're going to rate this out of 5 titty twisters. So yeah, I mean, everything about this movie is fun, except that it's just in a category below what I think are great films. Mm-hmm. And so, as a bad movie, this movie gets full marks, but it's also getting docked a mark and a half for not being like a self-contained great film. So I'm going to give it 3.5 titty twisters out of 5 titty twisters.
Okie dokie. Alex Wan.
Yeah, I really liked it. Had a lot of fun with it. Love the writing, love the action, and then it just goes off the fucking rails, but in like the funnest way possible. So I too will give it 3.5 titty twisters out of 5.
All right. I feel like I need to rate this one in halves because the first half definitely is like a 1 out of 5, but the second half for me, it's easily above 50%. So I'll give that one a 3 out of 5. So if we average it together, It's a 2 out of 5 overall for me. I don't know a movie that has made me like it in the second half after losing me for so long in the first half. And well done. Well done. A testament to the filmmaking. You know what? I'll bump it up. I'll give it an extra half mark. So 2.5 out of 5.
Nice.
Just for that. You pass. You pass, movie.
You pass, movie.
So that was fun. I enjoyed laughing about that movie. That's definitely worth the time it took to watch it. But now we got to cheer something. And Luke, you're going to cheer something that happened weeks ago when people hear this, I bet.
Yeah. Well, and I can cheer this in this sense because of the fact that this won't come out till after this event happens. So as long as the two of you don't spill the beans to any of my Nelson friends.
Danica, I'll tell you. No, I won't.
So as I mean, a lot of my cheers recently have been trivia oriented, and this one is the same. So I have been going to this one trivia night Thursdays so regularly that I have been asked to guest host.
Hell yes.
So on March 30th, I'm guest hosting at the Thirsty Thursday Trivia in Nelson. And
yay!
Like, this trivia, it's a little unconventional. It's got a shtick. Like, a lot of times they'll do a category that, like, the category is a clue to what all the answers are going to be. So it's like an example they'll do pass the mic, and every answer is someone named Michael or Mike, you know. So I have a few categories.
Prison Mike.
Shtick. Yeah, exactly.
Date Mike.
So Mike I have one category I'm making called the Oscars, where half of the questions are about the Academy Awards and half of them are about famous people named Oscar, you know, like that kind of thing. That. So, and I have, and the cheer. And this is like kind of tailored to Billy, is I think I've come up with the perfect category for Thirsty Thursday trivia, and it's called Simpsons by Another Name. So it's like a general knowledge category, but every answer will be a person who shares a first name with a Simpsons character.
I love that.
So
love that.
I know. It's going to be very fun. And it's just, it's stupid. You can actually make really great trivia out of it because there's so many characters and I'm excited to guest host.
That's so cool. Everyone, I hope you went to Thirsty Thursday Trivia on March 30th when this episode came out. That's so good. That's great. What are you cheering, Alex? Alex.
Oh, sorry.
What you watching on there?
I'm watching F1 right now.
Oh, okay.
Michael Schumacher.
That was my answer. I am cheering.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what I'm cheering. Yes. Ted Lasso season 3 just started.
Okay. That's good.
And yeah, it's a great show, and it was a good episode, and it's going to be the last season. So, you know, really, really appreciate when a franchise knows when to end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's nothing like knowing when to leave a party. You're like, this is it.
Take that, Scream.
Got him.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to the season. First episode has been good so far, and it's been such a good show.
I myself am cheering a movie I watched last night, which was like a surprising Harvey Keitel double feature, because not only did we watch From Dusk Till Dawn, but later in the evening, I had a little video date with Amy, and we watched The Grand Budapest Hotel, which he is in that movie, and I had seen it. I saw the movie when it came out in theaters, and I remember liking it, and then watching it again, it's just like, what a treat to look at. Like, just Wes Anderson's sensibilities on screen. It was way more violent than I remember for a Wes Anderson movie. A lot of people getting killed and fingers cut off and cats getting thrown out windows. So, but yeah, The Grand Budapest Hotel. Very fun. I love seeing Ralph Fiennes do a comedy role, a comic role, because he's usually so serious. And it was a great time. So
he's also kind of funny as M, you know, in the,
yes,
in the James, yes, Bond, yes, films. Yes. The recent ones, he does have that kind of sneaky comedic chops to him, doesn't he?
He's got a twinkle in his eye where you're just like, ooh, you're a very serious man, but he's like, am I? When I lived in London, I saw a movie that he made called The Invisible Woman, which was like, it was kind of like a Charles Dickens biopic, and he was doing an advanced screening, like a test screening we got tickets to, and he came.
Was he Dickens?
Yeah, he was Charles Dickens. Oh, nice. And he did a little like Q&A with the audience after, which was kind of cool to see. So I was like, you're a movie star. I just watched you on a movie star screen. It felt very, very fancy. I don't know if that movie made any waves, but I remember enjoying it.
Well, I'll probably watch it now because, you know, as you know, Charles Dickens is one of my favorite writers. So
you should check it out. Yeah, I think it's called The Invisible Woman. Okay, next week, we're continuing vampires. Alex, you're picking the vampire movie. What are we watching? What have you chosen for us?
We're going to watch Kronos next week.
Oh, can you spell Kronos that for me, please?
Kronos.
Kronos. I have no knowledge about this one.
Greek mythology or vampires?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe both.
It'll be embarrassing if there's no vampires in it.
I hope so.
But yeah, we're going to watch it.
Okay.
It's directed by Guillermo del Toro.
Hey, we know him. I'm a little bit surprised you didn't pick Twilight, but here we go.
Billy, I'm telling you right now, if you pick Twilight,
why are you surprised?
I am not going to watch it.
I'm not picking Twilight.
Why aren't you going to watch Twilight?
I will not pick Twilight. I've got something ready for my
Have you seen Twilight before, Luke?
I have not.
I have not, no.
You haven't seen it either,
Billy? I haven't seen Twilight. No, I haven't seen Twilight.
Oh, you two are missing out.
I think I'm not the target market.
It's actually got one of the greatest scenes, like, of our generation. Like, and I say that unironically. The baseball scene is fucking incredible.
You're a big Twilight fan. That's why
I'm not a big Twilight fan. I'm a big, like, baseball scene fan.
Okay. You respect a baseball scene regardless of genre.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're not watching Twilight. We're watching Kronos, which I had never heard of, and so that'll be fun. But we'll say goodbye. I'll say goodbye, dear listeners. Luke, say goodbye.
Goodbye, dear listeners.
Alex.
Bye.
How's the F1 race? Who's winning?
Perez.
Oh, good. Go Perez, I guess. All right. Anyway,
no,
folks.
No.
No, don't go Perez. Okay.
No.
Is Lewis Hamilton still racing? That's the only F1.
Yeah, of course he's still racing. Yeah, he's racing.
All right. Well, join us next week for Kronos. And remember, folks, they're just movies. There's nothing to fear. Thanks so much for listening to Nothing to Fear. We hope you enjoyed the show. And if you like what you heard, we'd love it if you left us a rating or a review wherever you got this podcast. Ratings and reviews are the simplest way to help our podcast grow and have people find out about us. You can also tell your friends about us. That would really help. Show them an episode. See if they like it. You can follow us on social media. The only game in town these days is Instagram. That's at Nothing to Fear Podcast. And if you have a little bit of money in your budget and you'd like to splash that around, you can go to patreon.com/nothingtofear and support us there. We have some content that goes up sporadically. We're all busy, but any amount helps, and you can get through the doors for as little as $1 a month. You can also listen to what the other two members of Nothing to Fear are up to. Luke does his podcasts, Really True Fiction and Liberal Soul. You can find those wherever you found this one. He also does his radio show, Full Spectrum Cinema, which I keep bugging him to make a podcast, so maybe one day he will. Otherwise, you can tune in to Kootenai Co-op Radio. Just Google it. Alex, of course, is world-renowned for his One Song a Day playlist on Instagram. On Instagram, go to One Song a Day. Check out what he's doing. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week.